This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Plans are moving ahead for a memorial and museum at the site of the Pulse nightclub. The One Pulse Foundation announced the design team for the memorial last month, and the architects outlined their vision for the site. They say the site will be a place to remember the 49 people who died, but also to learn about tolerance. Former Orange County Mayor Teresa Jacobs spoke at the unveiling of the plans. She says the museum and memorial could be transformational for young LGBTQ plus Americans and a way to start difficult conversations with their families. We're going to listen to part of that speech now.
We're here, first and foremost, to honor a commitment that we made that we would never forget our 49 angels. But it's very important that we give a lot of thought to how shall we remember them. History will remember them only by how they died, unless we intervene. Because we want to make sure that history remembers them for how they lived. Because Pulse wasn't just the place where people died. Pulse was the place that Barbara created so that everyone could come. Everyone could be accepted. Everyone could experience joy, a place of belonging, a sanctuary of celebration, a place where people came to dance in every sense of the word. And so our memorial needs to be a place for all of us, where we can do all of those things. For the survivors, for the family members, and the loved ones whose hearts were broken, who loved the fallen more than life itself, for our whole community, for the world, and for the generations yet to come. For those who will never know our 49 angels, they need to know that they're more than just names etched on a memorial. They are more than just additional victims of senseless gun violence. They need to know that they were human beings, each with their own unique story. They had unfulfilled dreams, and they left behind broken hearts. They need to know it because no one else can understand the magnitude of the void they left behind until they understand the richness and the vitality of the lives they lived. So, as we as a community think about what that memorial needs to be, it needs to be a place where we can still come together and gather, where we can still dance. It needs to be a place of life and joy. But it also needs to be a place of great reflection. It will be a place where people from all over the world will come, many on a pilgrimage, a journey of understanding and enlightenment. And Siri is very upset with us if you're not in the front row. But seriously, we all know that the number one cause of suicide among LGBTQ youth, the number one cause of death among LGBT youth is suicide. And I believe that tens of thousands, hopefully hundreds of thousands of lives will be saved because families will come to Walt Disney World or they'll come to SeaWorld or one of our other great reasons to come here. And teenagers will say to mom or dad while they're here, I want to go see Pulse. They'll say it because where's Siri when I need a distraction? They'll say it because they are struggling to have those courageous conversations with their parents. And they know that if their parents understand what a hate and intolerance and indifference and lack of acceptance does, their parents will understand. And they can have those conversations. So we are here today to save thousands of young people's lives. And some people will come just because they're curious. And I think for those of you so close to Pulse, that may be offensive. That may be really offensive. This is a sacred place. A sanctuary that became sacred ground. How dare somebody come here out of idle curiosity? You might think that for a minute. But think again. Because it is those people who come out of idle curiosity, that's where we have the greatest opportunity to change the world. If you asked any one of our 49 victims before they fell, if you had asked them, if you could create one legacy in the world, dream big, what would it be? Is there any doubt in your mind, those of you who knew and loved them, is there any doubt in your mind? Is there any doubt in your mind if I asked you that question, what legacy would you leave behind if I gave you the opportunity to create any legacy? Wouldn't it be a legacy where the world was Pulse? Where every nightclub was Pulse, where every church was Pulse, where every establishment, where every government entity was Pulse, where everyone was accepted, where there was no discrimination, and certainly not because of who you loved.
Listening there to part of a speech by former Orange County Mayor Teresa Jacobs. She gave that speech at the announcement of the winning design team for the Pulse Nightclub Memorial and Museum. And you're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation about the role of memorials in remembering the victims of mass shootings, how they can help a community address the trauma of these events. We're taking your comments and questions on Twitter at WMFE Orlando and your calls 1-866-338-5252. We're back in a minute. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking about the plans for a memorial and museum at the site of the Pulse nightclub. The design team for the memorial is led by Codify and Associates and includes a reflective pool and garden, 49 trees, a memorial walk from the site to the Orlando Regional Medical Center where most of the injured were treated, and a museum. We heard just before the break from former Orange County Mayor Teresa Jacobs, who says the site will save lives by opening conversations between LGBTQ youth and their parents. We want to hear from you too. What conversations do you think this memorial will spark? And what does it say about the conversation around LGBTQ community in America now? We're at 1-866-338-5252. Taking your comments and questions on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Joining us is Ken Foote. He's a professor of geography at the University of Connecticut and author of the book Shadowed Ground, which explores how and why Americans have memorialized or not the sites of tragic and violent events spanning three centuries of history in every region of the country. Professor Foote, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be here.
We're also joined by Christopher Cuevas. He is the executive director of QLatinx. Christopher, thank you as well.
Thank you for having me.
And State Representative Carlos Guillermo Smith, thank you for being with us as well, Carlos.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Christopher, I wanted to start with you. How important do you think it is to have this memorial, this place where people can gather and pay tribute to the people who died and I guess think about what was lost at that nightclub?
I think it's imperative that with any incidents of mass violence, as a community grieves, having a space that allows the hallowed grounds where violence occurred to be sort of rebirthed as a space of reflection and as a space that furthers that journey of healing is important. You know, whether we're talking about the Pulse site or other spaces that have experienced violence, it helps the community move forward in that lifelong journey of healing.
Mm-hmm. And I guess we've seen with the interim memorial, I mean, even before that was built or that was put up, people were coming to the nightclub anyway, leaving tributes, whether they were flowers or notes or messages. So people were gravitating there anyway.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Has there been a place that's kind of sprung up in the aftermath of Pulse? Because it seems as though this was a place where people would gather. It was kind of a gathering point for the LGBT community anyway. Has something come about in its place where people can go and feel safe?
You know, the history of our community is that nightclubs have always been the sanctuary for LGBTQ communities. And I think In needing to find safety, communities have looked at the sacredness of sort of LGBTQ nightlife. Mm-hmm. And another part of that is also needing to look for spaces outside of that. And so organizations all over have sprung up to build safe spaces that are not nightclubs for individuals that, you know, may not want that as a space to build connection or may want an alternative. So, Q Latinx is an example of that. There are many other organizations in the community that are growing organically to fill that gap, to address those needs.
Mm-hmm. And we heard from Teresa Jacobs in her speech talking about the importance of this memorial, you know, what it could be, a conversation starter for young LGBTQ folks. Do you think she's right when she says this could save thousands of lives?
I believe that the memorial sites and for incidences of violence are the starting point for conversations for us to record our history, and that includes the tragedies of our community, and that includes the tragedies of our history. I recently came back from Alabama, where I visited the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, where I walked through an experience that documented the lives of over 44,000 Black and African American individuals in the South who were lynched in the past 200 years in the United States. And that was a space that allowed for deep reflection and to reconcile with sort of the ugly history of our nation and the history of the South. And so I believe that this particular memorial will allow our community to sort of look at the ugliness of violence that LGBTQ people have experienced, for us to remember those that we've lost, for us to give honor to their legacy, and to remember that, you know, our fight for safety, our fight for dignity, our fight for equality is never ending.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking to Christopher Cuevas of Q Latinx about the significance of the Pulse Memorial. I want to hear from you as well. What does this memorial mean to you? What will it mean to you? Do you have plans to visit it? You can reach out to us at 1-866-338-5252 or send us your comments and questions on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Carlos Guillermo-Smith, I wonder what your kind of initial reaction is to, you know, looking at that design for the memorial. It's quite elaborate. There's a museum, there's the memorial itself, there's a walk as well. It sort of covers quite a lot of ground. What are your thoughts on it?
That's right. Well, my first reaction when I saw this design for the memorial and the museum was I just got chills all over. It's such a beautiful, beautiful design and a beautiful way to memorialize the 49 angels who were taken, in my opinion. I thought that there was certainly a lot of great ideas that were presented from community input, input from many of the survivors, many of the families and other folks who are impacted by this tragedy who provided input. And, you know, what really gives me comfort is the idea that it leaves a permanent footprint on the heart and soul of the city of Orlando, not just through a visual representation or an architectural representation, but also through a legacy, through honoring the 49 and remembering them in this way, in this permanent space, particularly not only in the memorial, but also at the museum as well, which could be a space in the future for future generations to learn about the consequences of hatred and intolerance, and how acceptance can really lead to positivity and happiness and full equality for every person. You know, June 12, 2016 was the darkest day in our city's history. But in the aftermath, we came together as one community, as Orlando United, to stand against that hatred and intolerance, and being able to memorialize that attitude and spirit of Orlando United is really important for future generations to be able to observe, to understand it, and to be able to build from it. I think Christopher was right, because what they were alluding to was that our fight for equality and justice is continuing. It's an ongoing process and struggle. And I think that these spaces, the memorial and the museum, are just beautiful, beautiful tributes and ways to preserve the legacy of those who were taken and those who rose from the ashes afterwards, the survivors and first responders.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News with Carlos Guillermo-Smith, State Representative from Central Florida, talking about the Pulse Nightclub Memorial and Museum and its significance not only to the people of Orlando, but also the wider LGBTQ community in Florida. Tweet here from Brandon, who writes in, "The Pulse Memorial will be the heart of the whole community and will educate and unite us together, but we can't forget that LGBT youths are abandoned by their families. I hope this will have a shelter. This will also have a shelter and get out the knowledge to the youth that they are loved." Thanks for commenting there, Brandon. Ken Foote, I want to bring you into this conversation. You've visited about 200 memorial sites across the United States in researching your book about the way cities and communities respond to tragedy and create memorials to remember the victims. What's it like kind of visiting all those? I mean, it must have an impact on you psychologically. What was it like sort of taking that journey?
I think it's very difficult visiting sites like this. They do have a tremendous emotional valence to them. And in some cases, I don't visit sites immediately after the events because the emotions are so raw, and it's very difficult to talk to people about some of these events. But I'm really impressed. Carlos and Christopher, I think, have really put their finger on some of the important roles that memorials like this play. The importance to the families to honor the victims and so on is oftentimes one of the most convincing arguments to put forward. But also, I think, because this was a hate crime, this was an act of terrorism against the LGBTQ population, that this could be a very, very important rallying point for stating rights in terms of resolving some of the issues that have been lingering so long. I'm thinking so often of the sites already mentioned, some relating to the civil rights movement, which, of course, also were accompanied by violence, but even Stonewall Inn in New York City. Not as deadly as this, but certainly a site that has now been commemorated and has become an important rallying point. So I think that idea of trying to place a marker at a site to honor the victims, to attend to the families, but also the point that this can be a point for discussion and debate and to raise these issues to make sure that they are resolved in the future.
It's interesting, though, Ken, I wonder just in your research into these different sites, kind of if you're struck by the different ways in which communities go about making the memorials, whether sometimes it takes longer than for others to decide on, you know, what to do and how to do that. I was listening to a story this morning about the response to the shooting in El Paso, Texas, and that Walmart there, it's been reopened. They've kind of renovated the store, but they've also put a memorial up nearby there, and that's happening now. So this is mere months after that tragedy, whereas in the case of Pulse, it's taken some time to get to the place we are now, and it's going to take even longer to actually build this. What does that kind of tell you about how it is that different communities go about marking a tragedy like this?
Well, I would say that there has been a change over the last generation, that events like this 10 years ago or 20 years ago probably would not have been marked at all. It would have been seen as so shocking and shameful that it would not have been marked or commemorated, or it might have been commemorated privately. But I think recently people acknowledge the fact that it's important to honor the victims, to put something there for the families to remember. And so events of mass murder, mass violence, and so on, which used to be kind of hidden away or effaced, are now recognized. But I think that's a recent change. And there still are cases where people are very edgy about marking some of these sites. So we know that at the Sandy Hook Elementary School here in Connecticut, of course, the building was destroyed, and there are plans to put up a memorial there, but that's still in flux after all of these years.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many sites where people, the tension there about how to remember the event is still very, very difficult to resolve. So sometimes we see this happen quite rapidly with the temporary memorials and so forth, but the debate can last for a long, long time, and sometimes it changes even after the memorial is put up.
Mm-hmm. Christopher, I want to come back to a comment from our listener, Brandon, about the notion of LGBTQ youth being abandoned by their families. Do you see some kind of educational element coming in and being important as far as this memorial, a place where people can sort of reflect on the challenges that youth go through and how they are sometimes left out and maybe not given the help and care they need?
Absolutely. I think that this memorial can serve as a space of shared learning for our community, not to only speak to the challenges of youth, but to speak to the broader challenges that LGBTQ communities are experiencing. In this year alone, we have, as a community, have experienced the loss of 22 transgender members of our family nationwide. Right, last year we lost 26 individuals. All of this attributed to violence, and this is the Black trans communities experience this at higher rates.
Mm-hmm.
And these conversations are often overlooked or underreported. And so this memorial site, it can serve as a space of education for the ongoing struggles that our community is experiencing, and also a space to activate our community into action and to follow the lead of the work that's being led on the ground by so many other phenomenal organizations and advocates who are really fighting for the dignity and the protections of our community.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News, talking about the plans for the Pulse Memorial and Museum. You can reach out to us with your thoughts. What do you think of the design? Is it a place that you will go and reflect? We're on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Send us a comment or question there. You can give us a call as well. We're at 1-866-338-5252. Carlos Guillermo-Smith, talk to us a little bit about the funding for this memorial and museum. What is the state putting into it, and is it enough?
Sure. Well, you know, the conversation around funding from the state for the Pulse Memorial and Museum actually started after the tragedy in Parkland.
Mm-hmm.
After 17 people were killed at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in 2018, the Florida legislature put together a new law, the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas School Safety Act, that in part appropriated $1 million of state resources, taxpayer money, to the construction of a Parkland memorial. And it was in that moment that actually I filed an amendment on the bill to offer equity to the Orlando and Pulse community by appropriating $1 million for this memorial and museum. We wanted to make sure that the Pulse community was not forgotten, as they often have been, especially in comparison with other tragedies. And although that attempt in the 2018 session failed, we came back earlier this year in the 2019 legislative session, and we partnered with Representative Holly Raschein and Senator Linda Stewart and others to request this funding through the formal budget appropriation process. We were very, very grateful that we actually secured $500,000 from the state in the last legislative session to help the One Pulse Foundation with operational costs and capital construction for this project. And even the fact that the state of Florida, which does not have a great record on supporting LGBTQ Floridians or causes, the fact that they appropriated these dollars, I think, is a huge sign that there's beginning that we're beginning to see movement on the Republican side. And of course, Republicans control state government, both houses of the Florida House, the Florida Senate, and also the governor's mansion. Mm-hmm. In fact, it became a really powerful moment when Governor DeSantis and First Lady Casey DeSantis herself visited the Pulse nightclub site this past June, on June 12, 2019, on the three-year mark to pay their respects. It was the first official visit by a sitting governor to the Pulse site in this public way. And I know that that had a tremendous impact on a number of people who felt that the previous governor had forgotten the Pulse community and left them behind. And when Governor DeSantis was there at Pulse nightclub this past June, he made a public commitment out loud that the $500,000 that came from the state of Florida towards this project was only the beginning, and that we would see the funding goal of $1 million for the Pulse Memorial and Museum from the state. We would see that through, that he would personally see it through as governor. And I think that that is an incredibly encouraging sign. And I understand that, you know, we would love for Governor DeSantis and other Republican leaders in the state to be more supportive of the Pulse community and also of the LGBTQ community, particularly LGBTQ communities of color that have been impacted by this tragedy. But sometimes an evolution on these issues, they don't happen overnight.
Right.
They take time, and we have to invest in these relationships with our state leaders to help them understand the scope and impact of this tragedy, so that they can support this cause.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to be requesting again more resources for this project, as well as other related initiatives, of course, that would support survivors and family members as well.
Right.
And I think that last year's appropriation of $500,000 was just the beginning. At least that's what I hope.
Right. I want to come back to something that Teresa Jacobs mentioned in her speech. She alluded to some of the controversy around the sighting of this memorial, the fact that some folks say maybe the money could be spent on something else, or that it's wrong to be putting in something that will be a tourist attraction for some people. And Ken Foote, in your kind of investigation into other cities and other tragedies and how they've dealt with these controversies, what is the best way through this? Or are there some lessons that Orlando could learn from other places, whether it's something like the site of the 9/11 memorial or maybe a tragedy not on that scale? But are there some lessons that Orlando could learn about how to sort of navigate those tricky waters?
Yeah, I think generally these sites do emerge as pilgrimage sites that oftentimes people are concerned about the mass tourism or whatnot. But oftentimes these are very much respected, and when they're commemorated, they take on that sacred role, like the was mentioned in the interview at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see that as a problem here. I think that the decisions that are being made are quite effective, because it's drawing in all of the people who have a stake in this memorial. Sometimes there are objections, because people don't want to have their family members remembered as victims, and sometimes being sensitive to what families want to have represented at a site can be very important in coming up with an effective design. But oftentimes the sites that I've visited are very impressive, and they do have that right balance of honoring the victims and also allowing some space for contemplation and for thought. So I think that generally the recent memorials have done a very good job of balancing these competing demands.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the fact that there's room for some input. I mean, the design for this memorial is presented as, quote, thoroughly imagined, end quote, but with room for public input into the final look of the memorial. Just how important is that public input into the design of memorials like these?
I think that's one of the innovations that took place after the Oklahoma City bombing of the Murrah building, is that people recognize that, that loss ripples outward from the victims who died through the whole community to the whole country, to the whole world. It's important to hear from people who are part of these various communities. That is, if we rely simply on the families, the survivors, and so forth, oftentimes they have very important issues and demands. But these events affect all of us in a variety of ways. And listening to those voices and responding to them, I think, is very important. And I think that's been included in the process of this design because it is such a multivalent memorial and event that those voices need to be heard.
Christopher, in the final minute or so that we have left here, I just wanted to come back to a point that you made at the start of our conversation, saying that it's not just nightclubs that you're thinking about now. You're thinking about sort of other safe spaces that you can create and other work you can do. And Q Latinx emerged in the aftermath of Pulse. Have the goals of Q Latinx changed? Do you feel like the scope is now broader in terms of bringing attention and awareness to the challenges of that face the LGBTQ plus community and what you need to be sort of focused on as you move forward?
So I'll say that our work has always been rooted in a pillar of healing, and that is in our idea done through building community and offering spaces of sanctuary and respite. And that continues to be a thread that leads through all of the work that we do, whether it's advocating for LGBTQ immigrants and making sure that they're safe in this state, advocating for communities to ensure that they are not discriminated in the workplace or in public housing, or ensuring that we're addressing the growing HIV epidemic in communities of color. To Representative Smith's point, there needs to be additional work done in supporting our community that has been impacted by this violence. A memorial site is instrumental in helping to facilitate the healing process. Mm-hmm. And there are so many other individuals that need quality access to affirming mental health services, the ability to access community care through, you know, establishing relationships with community spaces that offer safety and sanctuary. And so I hope that as a community, we can invest in those initiatives that are offering these direct services to individuals that are in need of sort of the hand-holding for healing.
Mm-hmm. So the work continues. Well, Christopher Cuevas is Executive Director of Q Latinx. Thank you so much for your time, Christopher.
Thank you.
We're also joined by State Representative Carlos Guillermo Smith. Carlos, thank you so much as well.
Thank you for having me.
And Ken Foote, Professor of Geography at the University of Connecticut and author of the book Shadowed Ground, about memorials to tragic events in the United States. Ken, thank you as well.
You're welcome.
Still to come, medical marijuana is taking root in the state of Florida, and that means a new wave of business. Our health reporter Abab Wright talks to Jose Hidalgo about the economy of medical marijuana. That conversation when we return. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Florida's cannabis industry is growing, with legal hemp and CBD in the works and a constitutional amendment to legalize recreational marijuana also on the horizon. But will Florida lawmakers clamp down on the industry as the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention continues to report more deaths from vaping THC products? 90.7 Health reporter Abab Araya sat down with Jose Hidalgo, the founder and CEO of Fluent Cannabis Care, a Florida medical marijuana company. Hidalgo starts by talking about the link between vaping deaths and black market marijuana products.
I mentioned this 2 years ago that I saw a huge problem with counterfeited product in the United States. Now, a lot of folks, when you talk here, hear people in the state of Florida, most of them don't know it's legal, which is shocking still today, 4 years later. But a lot of these guys are ordering products and they're buying them online and they ship it to them. So obviously, not knowing who they're buying from, not knowing what is in those products. You know, right now, there's several factors that are a risk to those that are consuming these products, besides not knowing the origin of the oil that is in this and what is cut with and whether it has pesticides or heavy metals or any sort of microbial that can be harmful. But I think what it has is raised the awareness of consumers and saying, maybe I should be buying products in my home state. Should it be legal so I can purchase a product that is safe?
Well, let's talk a little bit about that home state, because Florida has made this sort of progression from low THC medical marijuana to medical marijuana to smokable medical marijuana, and now there's a constitutional amendment for adult use. Talk a little bit about your role in that. Is that something that you're advocating for? Is that something that you guys are putting money into?
No. Although we are a public company, we are a small company in comparison to the universe of cannabis companies, and we're one of the pioneers here in Florida, so we're fortunate that we have that first mover advantage that we've been here, since 2015. What you're referring to right now is this looming constitutional amendment that is talked about. We're not involved with that. We're not part of that. We are supportive of anything that's going to create access and is going to provide products that are safer to Floridians. And I think this would be a step in that direction. We know you were talking about smokable flower. We know that when smokable flower came in the market May of this year, tons and tons of Floridians that were not registered with the state became registered. I see that as a good thing, meaning that these folks wanted a specific product, and because the product was not available, they were not in the program. And now that the product is available, that can only mean that they left the black market to come in into the regulated market. So I saw that as a positive. So I see this more as a continuation, as when and if. And I don't think it's an if, it's a when, whether it happens this next election year or whether it happens, it's going to happen sooner than later in Florida. We had an overwhelming support of the medical cannabis constitutional amendment in the last election cycle. So one can only imagine that there is significant support for that. Have these issues with the counterfeited product not happened, I think the chances would have been less. But I think that now that there's such a concern for these products that people are buying in the black market and some of the issues that are well publicized, I think that as a matter of safety and access. Now, the other stuff is that I believe that just like when the folks that were buying flower in the black market couldn't buy it in the legal market, once that became available, they joined the program. I believe that there's a lot of people that are still purchasing in the black market that don't want to go through the hustle of getting a car. Although I would tell you is when we started the program in 2015, it would take 3 months to get this card. Very cumbersome. It wasn't automated as it is today. Today, it takes 7 days. So from the day you see your doctor to the day that you can actually buy legal, tested, safe product in the state, it's a week. But I think that folks that are not dealing with very serious conditions, that are more, say, stress, not severe anxiety, have issues sleeping, have some benign form of chronic pain, those folks are probably continue to buy products in the black market. And I think that if and when it becomes available in the adult use, those guys are going to come in just like the people that were buying flour and say, okay, I'd rather go and buy a product that is well manufactured and tested. And you're going to see a bigger number of these customers coming into the market.
Have you seen an increase as well in people coming in since the news has sort of broken in the last few months about the vaping-associated lung injuries? Has that brought more people into maybe looking for the regulated products?
I couldn't tell you that because the growth of the population is kind of being very steady. So I haven't seen a slowdown. We would have to look at how many patients when those news broke, how many more people signed into the program. But what I can tell you that's very interesting, I get asked often, is have you seen a decline of your own vape products? And we haven't. So, of course, we were one of, I would say, we're the pioneers in educating the public in terms of safety, as I just told you earlier, not of just the oil that goes into the device, but the device itself. So, we have developed a reputation of being that safe manufacturer of product, but we have not seen a decline on that either.
I want to switch gears and talk about hemp for a few minutes while we still have a little bit of time. So Florida right now, we're getting ready to have these rules set up for the hemp industry. Now that the federal government has basically made a market for CBD products that can be legalized, do you see that as something that maybe you branch into, or do you see that as something that it's a different product and we're going to stay out of it?
No. So we already have one product, and we're rolling a second product that's derived from hemp. So the definition of hemp, and by the way, hemp is a cannabis plant. So they're all from the same family. Hemp, the definition of hemp is anything that has less than 0.3% THC. And I can tell you that we grow very medicinal plants that have maybe slightly above that, that are cannabis plants. So the definition in and of itself, what it talks about is any cannabis plant that has less than 0.3% THC that is considered hemp. I think you have, you can now see it on everything, right? So you there's hardly any place you can go without seeing hemp product. We take an approach as to, again, to provide a safely manufactured product for consumers. We have rolled out gummies that are made of CBD, and we're also rolling out drops that are made of hemp-derived CBD. These products are important because, one, we call it the Fluent OTC or over-the-counter, so you do not need a card. But those products are not meant to replace the medical cannabis products that are high in CBD and low in THC. Our products that are high CBD, low THC, the THC is 0.8% or less, which is almost three times what we consider hemp. But we also have products that are ratio-driven. There are 4 times CBD to 1 THC, 3 to 1, 1 to 1, and so on. And anytime you have a good balance of CBD and THC and the other cannabinoids, that's when they're the most medicinal and when they work better because they're well-known entourage effect. So for us, I think it's an important piece of the industry, given that the FDA is gonna be writing the rules as to what would be allowed to sell. You can advertise, we cannot advertise medical cannabis. So it's a way for us to get in front of the consumer, bring in some education, and explain to them, you know, what are the difference between the two, and also, you know, you have to make sure that not all these products are created equal. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of confusion there because it's not so regulated like the cannabis products that we're manufacturing, and because it's so difficult to enforce. You know, I talked to the folks in Tallahassee, and they tell me that there are so many of these businesses and there are millions of these products being sold on the street that it's literally impossible to police them because they don't have the bodies to enforce it.
I'm wondering, as someone who came from a finance background, is there an interest in hemp and CBD because of its federal status that maybe you can then take medical cannabis money that maybe is difficult to, you know, bank and moving that money into hemp and CBD?
We really don't have any issues with banking. I think that was an issue that's probably older. I mean, we don't have federal banks, so, you know, it's not like you can bank at one of the big banks. But there's plenty of banks that you can bank with. The transactions are, you know, cash in nature or debit cards, right? So in terms of the hemp as an opportunity for us in business, we are definitely looking into it. We're taking a very measured approach because there's just so much. The difference is that people, particularly in the state of Florida, they will look at our website and they say, okay, well, these are guys that are growing the product and they're manufacturing the product. They have a regulated or a physician consultation required product, and then they have a line that's an over-the-counter line. So I think that's going to create that trust that people feel they can buy our products.
And you're in multiple states. So talk a little bit about the differences that you're seeing in the market in Florida versus the other states you're operating in.
So currently, we're operating in Florida, Puerto Rico, Texas, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. I can tell you that Florida and Texas are very similar. Florida, as you know, we received the first of the original 5 licenses. In Texas, we have 1 out of 3 licenses that only exist there today. I would say these 2 states are very similar in complexity in terms of the demographic and the regulations. So they're vertical license in which you are responsible for everything from seed to sale, dispensaries, you name it. In Puerto Rico, the license is horizontal, so you would have to apply to the various types of licenses. In Pennsylvania, the licenses are horizontal as well. You have to apply for the various licenses. Michigan is as well horizontal, so you have to apply for the various disciplines in order for you to do the same that what we're doing here in Florida. Florida, Texas been medical, Pennsylvania been medical. They just passed adult use. So I'm assuming that they're writing the regulations, and at some point as early as 2020, I believe, adult use cannabis is going to be available in Pennsylvania. Michigan is in the similar process. I believe that some municipalities has opted in for adult use, and then that should also come into fruition sometime in 2020. Puerto Rico is still medical to this point. But again, the vast majority of the states are moving towards the adult use.
So you guys are operating in states that have that horizontal market. Have you, when you're operating in a state like that, are you trying to operate in each silo so that you're
Yes.
acting like a vertical market, even though you don't have to be?
Yes, we do. We have a very, we have our own strains that our customers have grown to like. So they come in, they ask for specific brands, whether it's Polaris, whether it's Subra, whether it's Baldor, whether it's Perla. So that's what we're unique. We're the only company in the space that brands the product that way. But also the horizontal market brings other opportunities because there's such, it's so difficult to keep up with demand that you will have the ability to bring your products to market, but you're also then are able to curate whatever products other people are manufacturing that you do your testing and you do your research and you feel comfortable carrying them at your stores, and you would do that. And then in some instances that you may do some level of contract farming, that you may outsource some of these less complicated to grow strains, and then you would purchase them from some of this stuff. So I think this is all positive for the industry, particularly the level of demand that we're dealing with, and it's so hard to keep up with it.
Well, and in Florida, courts have sort of looked at this vertical integration model and said this does not fit with the constitutional amendment that was passed, and it looks like we might be moving away from that.
I am all for more access. So I think that at a minimum, we should be looking at wholesaling in the state. So more products are available in more dispensaries. At this point, we can only sell the products that we make at our stores. So that will change that dynamic. And also things like reciprocity, for example. You know, this is a state with such a huge influx of tourism that anybody that has a medical marijuana card from any state, other states offer that, they should be able to come in the state of Florida and do that. That would also bring additional revenue to the state. Now, when you look at the potential of the adult use or recreational use, that's an entirely separate business. You know, that would have its own taxation, and that would then bring revenue into the state. And I think it will bring revenue not just by taxing the product, but also by additional number of tourists that will come into the state. But there are so many tourists that are coming from South America with the proximity to us. I think that can bring additional revenue to the state that way as well.
The argument you hear against that, though, is from, you know, sort of the Disneys and the Universals and the traditional tourism market that say, you know, we want to keep Orlando in particular as a very family friendly destination and a family friendly brand. Do you see validity in that argument?
Well, they sell alcohol in Disney, last I checked, right? So, you know, I think that this is alcohol, which is addictive. Like nicotine, like all the other hard drugs, and where you're dealing with a cannabis that is not addictive, but this is not physically addictive, it's mentally addictive, right? So I think that, speaking of Disney, a lot of people that are coming to Disney are already using cannabis products that are there. So obviously, I'm a parent, I have four kids. Do I think it is appropriate for people to be lighting joints in Disney? Absolutely not, right? Do I think it's appropriate for people to be lighting cigarettes walking in Disney? Absolutely not. But I think there is a way, particularly with these vape products that are discreet, the parks can actually ban the use of these products, and that is fine. But I do think that we shouldn't mix both things for something that is already happening. What I always say is this: these things are already happening. I was in an interview yesterday with a CBS station in Palm Beach, and they asked me what were my concerns about people driving. I said, they are already driving. The black market is a very predominant market and very dangerous market because it's just unregulated. If you look at Canada, for example, 75, even though it's recreational in Canada as a country, 75% of products that are bought in Canada are coming from the black market. So, you know, it is already there. I think regulation will be a good thing for one, making sure that people are buying safe products. And then whatever businesses decide, they can regulate it however they feel that they want to do. Municipalities can do the same, just like you can either opt in or out of having dispensaries. But I think this is something that is here to stay. And I think to the extent that we can understand better and get educated better as to what this means and why people are using it, I think that everybody would win.
Where do you think you're going to be in 5 years, in Florida in particular?
You know, I think that the chances of Florida becoming an adult use state by then, I think it will be very, very high. And I think that the industry will begin to morph and to grow and to become part of the day-to-day life of everybody. I think that's what you're seeing already. You're already seeing some of these cafes that are popping up in places like LA. You know, they're definitely ahead of the curve as they always are over there. And there's a lot of innovation taking place.
Well, Jose Hidalgo is the CEO of Fluent Cannabis. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Elizabeth Gondar. Production assistance for this week's show from Danielle Pryor and Abe Abaraya. Technical direction from Juan Gualder. If you haven't already made a contribution to our Fall Silent Drive, call 1-866-338-5252 or go to our website, wmfe.org. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.